Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Three views on what you should know about the Clinton email controversy. Later in the hour, the perspective of former Justice Department lawyer on the timing of FBI Director Comey's announcement. But we're turning first to journalist Aaron Blake. He's a political reporter for The Washington Post, where he writes about The Fix, and he's with us from Washington. Aaron, welcome. I'm pleased you're willing to take this on. Good to have you on the show.
Well, now you just made me nervous about it.
I think there's confusion about how an investigation into former Congressman Wiener's conduct online would have uncovered a new cache of Clinton emails. What can you clarify for us about that?
Well, basically, this is a completely separate probe that is tied to the Clinton investigation for basically no other reason than the fact that Anthony Weiner is married, now separated from a top aide to Hillary Clinton, Huma Abedin, who has been in the news quite a bit recently, has actually been off the campaign trail in recent days. But basically, because they, you know, her emails were on this computer that they found, that seems to be the connection to the Clinton campaign. We don't know much beyond that at this point. The FBI's statement that they released was rather vague, which is a big reason why it was controversial.
Right.
And so you know, we don't know what this is, but that seems to be the connection that has been drawn between Anthony Weiner investigation and a very, very separate investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server.
Just one note on that. So FBI agents search warrant on Abedin and Weiner's computer. And that's why they end up in this other investigation. And that's why they end up accessing this computer that has these emails on it. Is that your understanding of how this went?
That is my understanding. And, okay. And the interesting thing is that, you know, they came across these emails and they actually didn't initially have the proper authorization to review them initially. They just got a warrant on Monday, I believe, to actually review those emails, which was 2 days after the emails were announced as being existing. So this is a very complicated legal process, but so they were discovered during one investigation, and then they had to obtain a warrant to actually review them for a separate investigation.
Okay, so from reading about this, I understand that FBI Director Comey had promised Congress that he would be transparent about any new developments in this investigation. He seems to think that he was fulfilling that pledge. Why is it controversial?
Well, it's controversial because the protocol that exists in the Justice Department, and it's a process that was formalized by then Attorney General Eric Holder 4 years ago, is that they don't comment on ongoing investigations. They often, when you ask them about something that you believe is being investigated, won't even confirm that it's being investigated. They certainly won't give you details on it. And so in doing this, Comey essentially, according to his critics, broke this protocol and did something that could have an effect on an election. The flip side of that is, I think, you know, Comey made a decision here that the prospect of not disclosing the existence of these emails and then having it come out later after the election would also seem like it was being politicized, like it was being concealed. And
right.
So he made that call, and he's certainly taken a lot of heat for it. The Clinton campaign was initially very harsh on him, and other Democrats have even been harsher, suggesting that he might have broken the law and basically saying that he's playing politics here.
Is it significant that, as you say, the Justice Department warned Comey not to do this, and as you noted, that it would go against Justice Department policy? I mean, they can advise. They can't really tell Comey not to do it, as we can see.
Yeah, I mean, this is a call that he makes. He's the head of the FBI, rather. He doesn't even serve at the pleasure of the Attorney General Loretta Lynch. He serves at the pleasure of the president, and so, you know, he made a call. It's up to people to decide whether they think it was the right call. You know, whether it broke the law is another matter entirely. But, you know, certainly I think this was a situation in which there were very strong competing interests here that were weighing heavily upon Comey. And he decided that the best route would be disclosure rather than being accused of a cover-up eventually.
He is being accused by some, including a former Justice Department staffer and law professor here in Minnesota, of an abuse of power. Who would investigate that and determine whether that occurred?
It's up to the Justice Department, anything like that. The Justice Department investigating their own FBI director would obviously be a very significant thing. You know, the other question here is, you know, does Comey stay on as FBI director after the election in the new administration? That's certainly a very big question and something that I think is probably unlikely. But, you know, The legal question of, you know, it seems pretty clear that what he did here broke the protocol.
Mm-hmm.
The legal question here, you know, the idea that he broke the law is based on an entirely separate thing, which is called the Hatch Act. And
right.
The Hatch Act basically prevents public servants who serve in non-political offices from engaging in political actions related to elections. So, that's a pretty high threshold, actually, and Congress has weakened that law in recent years. So I think it would be a tall order for them to actually get him in legal trouble over this. It's more of a, I think, a talking point at this point to suggest that what he did was wrong.
Aaron Blake is the first of three guests that we're going to have on this hour to work through a lot of these questions that have come up and confusion around this latest release or this latest probe into the Clinton emails. We learned about it on Friday. There's a lot of concern on the part of the Clinton campaign that it has changed the dynamic of the race. You hear Donald Trump talking quite a bit about it on the campaign trail. And we're trying to bring some clarity to the details of this and understand what's really happening when you hear the competing campaigns giving their views of it on the campaign trail. So Aaron is a political reporter for The Washington Post, writes for The Fix and other political pieces, and with us from Washington. How long, Aaron, do you have a sense of how long it's going to take for FBI agents to determine whether there are duplicates, as I think Comey has acknowledged that there may be? How long is it going to take for them to figure this out? Would it happen before next Tuesday?
I don't know how long it's going to happen. It is very unlikely, I think, that there would be any kind of resolution or even a semi-resolution of this issue before Election Day. I think if there was the prospect of that, the FBI may not have announced it at all. They would have just waited and said, you know, we reviewed this and here's what was in it. I think, you know, he wanted to get this out there far enough before Election Day that it could be processed and it wouldn't look like it was, you know, dropped on the eve of the election necessarily.
Wow. But it was kind of.
But it was kind of. But, you know, I think he got it out there relatively quickly after he learned about it. The emails were reportedly in the possession of agents, but he hadn't been alerted to it for a couple weeks. And so his choice was basically to, you know, choose between disclosing it, you know, as soon as he did with 11 days left in the election, or wait and see if they could get some resolution. But if they didn't, the disclosure would come even closer to the election and look more like a political move on the FBI's part. And so, again, a lot of bad options for James Comey, and he made the one that he felt most comfortable with.
Can you give me a sense of what you make of Senator Chuck Grassley, a senior senator from Iowa, writing this, and a Republican, writing this letter where he basically excoriates Comey for these decisions? I mean, what kinds of signals are we getting from Congress around that, and what's Grassley really worried about?
Well, it's a pretty remarkable situation in which we've seen a number of Republicans come out against Comey, even as he's done something that would seem to help the Republican presidential nominee in this case. And I think there is a you know, another one was Congressman Jim Jordan from Ohio, who's kind of a conservative thought leader in the House. I think that there is, one, not a whole lot of affection for Donald Trump among these Republican senators and congressmen.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that makes them a little bit more likely to speak out on this. And I also think that, you know, they do believe in the legal process as it exists and in the protocol that exists in these kinds of investigations. And I think that they're worried about the precedent that this sets as far as the politicization of the FBI's investigation process. They don't want this to kind of get into a slippery slope towards the FBI disclosing investigations frequently and even doing it on the eve of an election. So I think they see a bad precedent here, even as this situation may be particularly unorthodox and unprecedented.
Okay, a couple of politics and media questions for you. Donald Trump is telling people, telling crowds on the campaign trail that the FBI has reopened the investigation and this is worse than Watergate and all of that. What's the challenge for reporters who are covering Trump out on the campaign to try to clarify? You know, those things are not true. The investigation has not been reopened. This is a separate investigation. And I think there's nobody else who says it's worse than Watergate. How should the media handle that? How have you been handling some of what he's saying about this?
Well, it's certainly true that there were many claims made about this announcement which were not borne out by the facts in James Comey's letter. The investigation wasn't reopened. It was an investigation that was still open from back in July. Even as there was somewhat of a resolution back then, Comey made clear that they would continue to look at anything that came to their attention in relation to the investigation. So, you know, and the idea that this is somehow a big, you know, game changer, we just don't know what's in those emails. We don't know how many of them are duplicates. And I think a lot of the coverage has referenced those facts. But it is a fact that we don't know what is in those emails. Could it be something extremely significant? Of course it could. And this is a person who is still favored to become the next president. And so, you know, claims, you know, we've been fact-checking Donald Trump's statements, you know, throughout this campaign and call them out when he said things that aren't true very frequently. And then I think it's for the voters from there to decide whether that bothers them or not. And
okay,
that's something that, you know, hasn't been a deal breaker for a lot of voters so far in this campaign.
Okay, and that's my last question for you, Aaron, is Hillary Clinton is telling crowds that she thinks voters have already reached conclusions about the emails. In other words, it's baked into how people are viewing the campaign and that the new development probably isn't going to change many minds. Are you seeing polling that would, including the Washington Post ABC poll, that would dispute that?
It is true that Donald Trump is rising in the polls to some degree, but that was happening before the Comey announcement, and so it's not clear how much of this has to do with the email situation, how much of it is just Republicans towards the end of this election deciding that they want to support Trump after all when they had been hesitant. It is a situation, though, where, you know, if this is something that causes even 1% or 0.5% of Hillary Clinton's supporters to decide on election day, you know what? I'm just not going to turn out to vote because I'm frustrated by this.
Mm-hmm.
That could be a significant thing. And so it's really hard to know whether that's the case. Most voters say this doesn't matter to their vote. But if it matters even on the margins like that, that's when this starts to be a problem. And so I think that's why the Clinton campaign came out forcefully on this and denounced Comey pretty quickly.
Aaron, thank you as always. Good to talk.
Thank you, Carrie.
Aaron Blake is a political reporter for The Washington Post. One of three views this hour on trying to bring some clarity to this new email controversy that some people are waiting to find out. Is it changing the overall atmosphere and the horse race here in the race for president? So we'll talk with a lawyer, former lawyer in the Justice Department, to give us some insight on the legal questions that have been brought up here. We'll do that after news to Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Police say the suspect in the killings of two Des Moines area police officers is in custody now. They say Scott Green was taken into custody without incident this morning in Dallas County, just west of Des Moines. He is suspected in the killing of a Des Moines police officer and an Urbandale police officer earlier today. Both officers were allegedly shot while sitting in their police cruisers. According to court records, Green was jailed and charged after resisting Urbandale police officers trying to pat him down for a weapon in 2014. Donald Trump's campaign is firmly rejecting the embrace of a newspaper affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan. The latest issue of The Crusader used Trump's Make America Great Again campaign slogan as its headline for an editorial praising the catchphrase and the Republican presidential candidate. The newspaper bills itself as the premier voice of the white resistance. In a statement, the Trump campaign calls the newspaper repulsive. A spokesman for a leading Shiite militia says its fighters have gained control of a highway linking the city of Mosul, held by the Islamic State group, to the Syrian city of Raqqa, which the militants consider their capital. The spokesman for the Hezbollah brigades says his troops are now cutting the main supply line to the militants. Earlier this week, Shiite militias joined the operation to retake Mosul from the Islamic State. And there's been a shakeup in the Minnesota Vikings coaching staff. Offensive coordinator Norv Turner has resigned. Head coach Mike Zimmer is expected to talk more about the change later today. Turner's resignation comes just days after the Vikings' second defeat of the season. In each, the team was able to score only 10 points. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:23.
Lots of college students take out loans to pay for school. Sometimes, though, that very process turns out to be educational.
I just took it because it seemed like no one who had that much money would give it away without me probably being able to pay it back easily, you know?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How much students actually do know when they take out those loans? The story next time on Marketplace.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, we'll continue to explore and discuss solutions for how to address the steep increases in health insurance premiums that are coming. What should Minnesota lawmakers do to fix it? We'll bat around ideas at 11.
Programming is supported by Spire Credit Union, a provider of financial products and services designed to improve the financial well-being of their members. More at myspire.com, driven by Midwestern values.
Programming is supported by SFM Mutual Insurance, focused on workers' comp programs that can create long-term positive results for employers and their employees. You can ask your independent insurance agent or visit sfmworkerscomp.com.
Screen time coming a little later in the hour. We're going to talk about how Marvel Comics has taken over Hollywood, and we're doing that ahead of a show tomorrow at 10 that I want to talk to you about. We're going to take note of the fact that the United Nations has named Wonder Woman as its symbol of empowerment for girls worldwide. Yes, highly controversial. We're going to talk about the decision and the power of symbols and whether Wonder Woman stands up as a symbol for female empowerment worldwide. So that's coming up tomorrow at 10. We'll talk a little bit about Wonder Woman and Batman and Marvel Comics and Hollywood today on Screen Time. But this hour, it's a conversation of three views on what you should know, trying to understand the Clinton email controversy. And Peter Zeidenberg is joining us now. He's a partner at Arent Fox in Washington, D.C., and a former federal prosecutor who worked in the Justice Department for 17 years. Peter, thank you so much for being willing to do this. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Will you give me a sense of the competing legal and ethical arguments that Director Comey would have had to consider as he decided whether to alert Congress to this and go public with this new probe?
Well, Director Comey was in a little bit of a box of his own making because he made the decision to do this press conference back in July, which was quite extraordinary and, in my view, an inappropriate decision.
Uh-huh.
It's not the job of the FBI director or anyone else from the Bureau to be laying out a case when there is no indictment. It's inappropriate. And notwithstanding that there's great public interest in it, that's not the test. There's all kinds of public interest in all kinds of things, but it's fundamentally unfair to anybody to have law enforcement, you know, lay out their investigation when there's no formal way to respond. So that was number one. Then he went ahead and he agreed to testify about this and laid out more details. And during that hearing, he said that he would keep Congress apprised, which was a second or if not third mistake. It shouldn't have gone in the first place, but he certainly shouldn't have committed to keeping Congress apprised because that's not their job, to be apprised of the internal workings of the Justice Department as they work through an investigation. It's a separate branch of government. They should be told to butt out until there's a case to be brought, and they'll bring it when there's a case.
Okay, well, let me ask you this about that, though. I mean, Congress has, as you said, Congress called on Comey earlier this year to testify. He answered numerous questions. Why isn't it Congress's purview to ask the director of the FBI what's going on with these investigations?
Well, they can ask. I'm saying it's not his job to answer those types of questions. You simply say the matter's under investigation. I'm not going to comment further. When we have a case to bring, you'll be the first to know. You know, it's just not appropriate to talk about ongoing criminal investigations. And then finally, you know, the last straw was this decision on Friday to write this letter, apparently because he felt like he had to follow through on his earlier promise to keep Congress apprised. And he's keeping them apprised of information that is so preliminary, so nascent, that it is meaningless. I mean, this to say, in his letter, he said, we found emails which may be pertinent. Okay, that means they may not be.
Right.
That means they may have emails that have already been looked at, or they may have emails that have absolutely no connection with the investigation. And he is doing this 11 days before a presidential election. And, you know, it's ironic in that Director Comey at that July press conference was excoriating Secretary Clinton for what he called her recklessness. And I think what Director Comey did was textbook definition of reckless. This was a premature disclosure. There was no reason to tell the Congress or anyone else until, at the very least, these emails had been vetted. And if that's after the election, that's after the election. But to have all of this hyperventilation over information which could very well turn out to be meaningless is, I think, really, you know, to say it's unfortunate doesn't really begin to do justice to it.
Peter, we have a University of Minnesota law professor here who was with the Office of the Special Counsel in the Bush administration, Richard Painter, who has filed a formal complaint against the FBI. He says that Comey violated the Hatch Act. What does the Hatch Act do again? And do you agree with that assertion?
No, I don't. The Hatch Act prohibits political conduct by people while they're in office, you know, federal officials, federal employees. You can't be campaigning while you're, you know, you're working in your government job. And, you know, I don't find that to be a, you know, a legitimate beef to take. You know, that's not, I don't think Director Comey broke any laws.
Okay.
I think what he did is exhibited extremely poor judgment.
Peter Zeidenberg is with us, part one of our three views today on trying to understand the details of the Clinton email controversy. Comey, as Mr. Zeidenberg says, went public essentially late last week with details about this discovery of this cache of emails. This is complicated to lay out. Discovery of this cache of emails on Huma Abedin's, a Clinton aide's, computer under a different investigation into Anthony Weiner. And then, as we've been saying this morning, went public with the fact that they are looking into these emails. Peter, I should ask you, just to understand this. So this is a different investigation into Anthony Weiner and his conduct online, potentially with a 15-year-old girl in North Carolina. The FBI served a search warrant and seized the computers. Is it possible the Huma Abedin is the one that they're really interested in, and that this association with Clinton, you know, is getting all the attention, but that's not where the real focus of the FBI is?
No, I don't think that that's,
why?
That's likely at all. I think because I don't think they would need to have this subterfuge about what they're investigating, and they make representations to the court when they get these search warrants about what the investigation is that they're looking at. So, you know, I think they took the computer, as they said, because it was part of this sexting investigation.
No, I guess I don't think I asked that well. I guess what I'm asking is it possible also that Huma Abedin might have had classified material on these devices that she wasn't treating as classified, and so she could be in the kind of trouble that has come Hillary Clinton's way? No?
Is it possible? You know, all kinds of things are possible, you know, but that's the point. Nobody knows. And so making these announcements now is what's so problematic about it. Could she have exposure? Yeah, possibly. But I'll tell you, the reason why Secretary Clinton, the FBI, why Director Comey said back in July that no reasonable prosecutor would ever bring such a case is not because that no classified information was sent. It's because although it was sent, there was absolutely no evidence of an intent to share that classified information with someone who was not authorized to receive it. It was being sent between people with classified clearances.
Mm-hmm.
So it was being sent under an unsecure server, which was, as he said, careless or reckless. Okay. Well, that doesn't prove intent. That proves you are careless. To show intent, you have to do it knowingly and intentionally. So the fact that if it were to come out that Huma Abedin sent information to Hillary Clinton and it was on an unsecure server, in all likelihood, the same analysis would apply.
Here's another question I want to ask you specifically about that. There are, among others, Trump and others, saying that the carelessness or whatever this was of treating this classified information put the country at risk. Is that potentially true?
Not from what we've heard. No, absolutely not. The information, as we've heard described, was confidential. Okay, confidential information is the lowest level of classification. So it's below secret, it's below top secret. And it was, they were discussing drone programs in the Middle East or in Pakistan, which everybody knows were ongoing. Okay, but technically those programs are classified, or they haven't been unclassified, though it's common knowledge. It's written about in the papers every day. Is our national security being compromised because it's being discussed? What's on the New York Times front page? I don't think so. I mean, given that far more secret information is disclosed on a regular basis by WikiLeaks, and Donald Trump is celebrating it every time it happens, it's really hard for me to take seriously his concern that this is a breach of our national security that's endangering our republic.
Okay, I have one last question for you about that. Is it clear that the rules for cabinet members, secretaries, top-level staffers, and private servers have been forever changed, should be forever changed, that we're not going to see this kind of use again?
Well, I'm sure I would find it very hard to imagine, one, that it ever happened before. I mean, the whole thing was quite unexpected,
unusual?
To say the
okay.
least. I mean, unusual doesn't begin to describe it. I mean, who even knew you could have a private server? I mean, you know, well, I never heard of such a thing. So to think anyone's ever going to do it again, I mean, I can't even imagine. And you know what? Frankly, going forward, if someone were to do it, it would be a whole different legal analysis if you were to do it then, because you would say you were on notice about this.
Peter, I really appreciate the time and the insight on this. Thank you.
Okay, happy to be helped.
Peter Zeidenberg is a former federal prosecutor who worked at the Justice Department for 17 years and now a partner at Arent Fox in Washington, D.C. We're hearing three perspectives on the Clinton email controversy that erupted anew late last week, hearing the specifics of the situation, the legal implications, and now how it's affecting the campaign and the media coverage. Hadass Gold has been writing about the campaign and the media for Politico, and she joins us now from Washington. Hadass, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi, great to be with you.
I'm kind of smiling because all this frustration over the confusion about this this email controversy is kind of coming out in our guests' voices. So, and I get that. This feels like a campaign where, you know, I think as Peter said, who would have ever guessed this, where the media has really struggled to be ahead of the curve, but is often behind it. And, you know, these revelations seem to erupt every other day. What's your assessment of how what it's been like for campaign reporters to keep up with these developments?
Well, I mean, already a campaign is always a fast-paced world where there's constant revelations. But when we look back, for example, at a 2012 campaign where those revelations were things like that Mitt Romney spent a longer time at Bain Capital than people thought, or that he had a car elevator, or things like that, they seem quaint compared
yeah, they
to what
do.
We're dealing with now.
Good point.
Where we have possible connections to Russia and from within the Trump campaign. We have FBI investigations. It's really stunning, and these are much, much kind of higher level issues that we're dealing with than, for example, with maybe look at Barack Obama and the Reverend Wright and the sermons that he gave. Again, it's just such a different world, and we're dealing with some really serious kind of earth-shattering implications. Everything, like I said, from the possible Russian connections to an FBI investigation that, however you might feel about Hillary Clinton, it is still notable that it's even happening.
Right.
And it is really stunning to see how reporters have had to deal with it. I think that overall, the media has done a decent job. I think very rarely would anybody give the media, an A-plus grade on how they do anything.
That's right. Never. And we're used to that, right? Okay, so let me ask you this about the kind of follows up on what you've just said.
Mm-hmm.
One of the challenges, I think, for the campaign reporters is trying to correct the record in real time of what these candidates are saying. And this has been especially challenging with Donald Trump. So I thought we'd play a little bit of something that Donald Trump said shortly after the email controversy went public, and then talk about what campaign reporters have to try to do to correct the record. Let's listen.
As you know, the FBI has reopened its investigation into Hillary Clinton and discovered, you heard this yesterday, it's hard to believe, and discovered another 650,000 emails. She lied under oath when she turned over all of her work-related emails. Just one more lie out of so many.
Okay, so much there to try to correct. A, they have not reopened the investigation against Clinton. This is a different investigation. There is no proof that she lied under oath. What does a campaign reporter do to try to clarify the record on that?
I mean, it is really incredible that in a single rally that Donald Trump has, he often makes so many false statements that a lot of them that would have otherwise brought down any other candidate just fly under the radar. One of those things is including he consistently repeats that the crime rate or the murder rate in a certain city is the highest it's ever been in 45 years. And that almost always is false, entirely false. The problem is that it's kind of like when you have such a stream of things coming at you, you kind of have to grab at your biggest ones. And oftentimes, you can't In order to correct it in real time, a television station or something like that would have to literally break into the to the coverage and say, "Hold on a second, guys, this isn't true." And okay, hold on a second, guys, this isn't true either. And we have started to see over time that networks have started to do that somewhat in their chyrons, which is that lower title.
Really?
Huh. But we're not seeing it that often. A lot of times they'll do it in, you know, because you have to do it super quickly. They will say, Trump, colon, the murder rate is the highest it's ever been, and then they'll do in parentheses, it's not. Which I think is a probably good progress, at least, because it is providing some context in fact-checking. And cable news heads, including people like Roger Ailes and Jeff Zucker, have all admitted that maybe they shouldn't have shown Trump's rally so unedited in the early days, and maybe they should have provided more context for it. But it's one of those situations where we're used to kind of more or less maybe trusting our government or our politicians, something like that, to at least give the facade that they're telling the truth. And with Donald Trump, there's not even kind of an attempt at it. And even when he's sent out false or misleading information, I don't think I've ever really seen him admit to it or apologize for it. And so it kind of falls upon the media to try and follow up and catch up with that. But by then, it's usually too late because that information is out there.
Well, and we're also in this, and you know this, we're in this atmosphere where facts aren't facts. They're the facts you want to believe from the source that you decide to get your news from. I say what I've wondered about this, you probably are too, is whether something, the normal has changed, or this is just an exceptional kind of situation and we will go back to the usual rules of the road. I fear something essential has changed.
I think something has definitely changed, but I do believe that Donald Trump is a unique candidate where he is somehow able to say these types of things and get away with it. I mean, look at what when Hillary Clinton, and this isn't the same thing in terms of like lying necessarily, but when she described Donald Trump supporters as deplorables, she got hammered for it, she apologized for it, and she's still getting hammered on it to this day, whereas you have Donald Trump with just like a litany, like a list of people that he has literally New York Times published two full pages of insults that he has thrown at people, including, you know, calling Mexican immigrants, illegal immigrants, rapists, and saying that John McCain wasn't a war hero. And it just doesn't seem to stick in the same way. I think because he is just like throwing out so much information all at the same time that it's so hard to keep up. And with Hillary Clinton, it's kind of like one thing every few days that she says that might be something that people can dispute. But I think a lot of it also depends on who wins. I mean, if Donald Trump is president and the president speaking from the podium at the White House continues to say that, that's an even higher platform with an even kind of higher bar to challenge something like that. And nothing's to say that he would in any way change how he acts just because he's president. I expect that we'll see a lot of the same where he's going to start claiming things or saying things. And mind you, I'm sure he believes them. Kellyanne Conway, his campaign manager herself, has said once when someone challenged her about something that Donald Trump tweeted about some video that ended up not being true, she said, well, she said, I don't know, I haven't been with him today. Maybe somebody showed him some video. So if that's all it takes, somebody showing Donald Trump some internet video, then we might have a lot to deal with when he's president.
Yeah. I read your piece last week where you wrote about this, the idea of the protective press pool, and that neither Clinton or Trump have accepted it. So my question is advanced beyond that. Are you seeing some signs that press access is going to be a problem no matter who wins this race for president?
Yes, it will be a problem no matter who wins.
Really?
I think it will be worse under a Trump presidency, and I think it will be much more selective and kind of favoritism under a Trump presidency, but I think we'll see in both situations it won't be as good. I've gotten kind of behind-the-scenes affirmations from the Clinton campaign staff members that if she becomes president, it will be the similar level of access as the press corps has now with President Obama, which means that they will have a protective press pool, which follows the president around every moment. You know, if he's in the White House, they're in the White House. If he's gone, they're gone. They travel within his motorcade. And to be clear, Hillary Clinton has what we call a quasi-protective pool. So the press does travel with her on the plane, which you've seen all those press gaggles where they're talking to her on the plane.
Right.
So they see her all the time. They're within in her motorcade, so they're not they don't have to contend with traffic like if they weren't part of the motorcade. They can get to things on time, but it's not fully protective in that they're with her every single step of the way. She might still kind of steal off and do her own thing. Donald Trump doesn't have anything even close to it. He doesn't allow the press to be on his plane with him. They don't travel in the same motorcade as he does, which causes a lot of problems, including when they get left behind at events, and then Donald Trump makes fun of them for being left behind at events when really it's
because that's right.
He didn't let them travel with him on a plane. It's kind of crazy, but Hillary Clinton is obviously is very wary of the media. She obviously did not give a lot of press conferences for a period of time. Now she's given many more than Donald Trump has, but and also people should remember that a lot of journalists have complained for a long time that Barack Obama is not as transparent as a president as others have been, and this has been a continuing trend towards less and less transparency and access within the White House press corps because the presidents don't need the media like they used to need. Now Obama can just do a Snapchat story or tweet some things out, or you know how he has his White House press photographer who can follow him around and immediately release images, and this has caused for a lot of frustrations within the White House press corps about how they interact with the president and with his senior staff. And so I'm fully expecting, no matter who wins, you know, that it would continue on that trend.
Hadas, thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Hadas Gold is a media and politics reporter for Politico.